Welcome back to the M&A Zing, a weekly podcast for search funders, acquisition entrepreneurs, holdco builders, and more in the UK, Europe, and beyond. I'm Gareth Hawkins, and I am honoured today to be joined by search fund royalty. It could be said that if the Gilded Age was defined by the writings of Mark Twain and the Jazz Age in the life of F. Scott Fitzgerald, then the search fund era is personified in one man, if I haven't built him up too strongly. Bramley Johnson, it's an absolute pleasure to have you with us, sir.
Oh gosh, that's quite the intro. I appreciate it. I'm glad to be here. Maybe my father, but I will be a lot more humble on that one. But I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Well, your humility is one of your greatest charms, but I think it's fair to say you've seen it from the inception, right? You're born to a family that was heavily involved in search funds, and the apple hasn't fallen far from the tree. You, former director of the International Search Fund Center, up till very recently. You've done your own search. You run some investment firms. You back some searchers, and now with Victorian Equity, you're launching a sort of investment vehicle specifically for searchers in Europe, which is fabulous. So we're getting to all of that, but am I too far off the mark?
No, that sums it all up. All of that is true, and it's been quite a journey. And I've stayed in it because I love the community. It's just such a great community to be part of, and I hope it stays the same way for many, many years.
Likewise, you've seen different sorts of investor community, and as have I. You know, I've done some time in venture and private equity and property, and I can't help but feel a love for this space, the collaboration, the bias for action, the sheer intelligence and capability. It's all very addictive. I think we're united in that sort of kinship over the greatness of this space. So let's get into it, Bramley. Your family's involvement in search funds dates back to like the 1980s when Irv Gruusbeck and the ilk brought it to the world for us. Can you share any reflections on how you've seen the model specifically evolve from those early days to where we are today in 2025?
Sure. I mean, so we go back to Jamie Turner and Kirk Reinger, who were some of the very first searchers out there to acquire and grow a business. And we've since done a lot of firsts. We invested with Simon Webster, the first international searcher ever, Mark Bartomeus, the first Spanish searcher. And so we've ticked a lot of those boxes. And we've seen the community go from a very small group to exploding really in a massive way. When I did my search 100 years ago in Los Angeles, I was one of maybe, gosh, our cohort was maybe 12 people or something along those lines. I'd venture to guess that it could be 12 in just a neighborhood down in LA. I don't actually know the numbers, but there's an enormous amount of searchers, dozens and dozens in California and all over the country. And we've certainly seen that explode here throughout Europe. So we're seeing a lot of things flood into the ecosphere, and it's been good and bad. There's been pros and cons on both sides of it. But I think the biggest thing has been trying to stick to the traditional model. It's something that when I was in the International Search Fund Center working with Simon and Jan Simon and Jürgen Rieling, we wanted to make sure that the traditional model was something that was really focused on at the conferences and really sort of repeated over and over because it works. I mean, we have this model that really works, that's worked for several decades now. There's no point in reinventing the wheel. And as with everything, I think you get people that come into a space and they think they can do it better. And so they try and adjust things here or there and that kind of stuff. And so our focus was to keep it the same. But there's been a ton of changes and twerks and things like that that we've seen, tweaks and twerks and everything else that we've seen through the process over the years that have been for better and for worse in some cases.
Yeah, I think most of investment products, if we can call it that, are in a state of iteration, if not evolution. You've got to stay ahead of the curve. Times change. I mean, I'm for one saying, does it really take 2 years now in this modern era to find a company and get it over the line? Often it does from the relationship building perspective, but with the tools we have available to us today, that could be more expeditious. What could you speak to about why it was an attractive proposition back then, and perhaps why it still remains so now? You mentioned it works. Well, From an investor standpoint, what specifically works about it?
Yeah, you know, well, I think it's the key is that all interests are aligned, right? Everybody's aligned, the seller, the entrepreneur, the searcher, and the investors are all aligned in the same goal to be able to maximize this sort of company and grow it. And they understand sort of there at least wasn't the windows of like, okay, now we need to exit, now we need to do this. There was a lot more flexibility and the ability to do to build this company. And then ultimately it was the searcher who, provided he hits the metrics and everything else, really comes out on top. So they really do run the business. They really are in charge. They really are the CEO. There's no boss. And I think that's really important and key when we're seeing a lot of these newcomers that come in and they want to take, you know, 40 or 50% of a deal, you know, or more, or they want to do the entire thing. And I see this a lot where they're like, oh, I'm going to raise, you know, $100 million. I'm going to go out and find these businesses and I'm going to stick CEOs in them. And it's like, all right, well, that's private equity kind of thing. That's not search. And that's not the point of search because they're not really the CEO. You're the boss. You can fire them whenever you want. Now, of course, we can fire a CEO if we need to in a search fund acquisition, but all the investors need to come in on that. They need to agree on that. You get a room of 12 investors in a room, you're going to get 12 different opinions, right? So it's not always that easy, and you really need somebody to be doing something egregious. And of course, the last thing we really want to do is fire a CEO anyway, because it's, you know, we have to replace that. It becomes a real problem, and you can see the negative issues that would happen within a company. So I think that, go ahead.
Well, I was going to just drill into that a little bit because sure. there is a kind of an emerging noise that seems to be kind of getting the occasional repost, for want of a better phrase, about incidents of firing search fund CEOs. I don't know if you've seen some of the apocryphal kind of stats, whether they really are legit stats or not. But, you know, like you say, no one wants to fire the CEO unless it's really tanking. I can't for one minute believe that there's that many that are tanking that badly that are going to require that sort of intervention. But do you see it happening frequently?
No, I don't see it at all. In fact, I've been in one deal personally, and I can't speak to my father's deal. So when I was younger, when he was doing tanks, you know, through the 90s and whatnot, I was not obviously intimately involved in those. But from the deals that I've been in, there's only been one case where we fired a CEO over all the dozens of deals that we've done. And who wants to? I mean, it's not good for the business. It's a headache for everybody. You don't know who you're getting in. I mean, one of the big things that I, and this goes to Victorium and what we're doing with Victorium, is that I always try and explain to people that the baseline of your investment is the company, right? So the assumption is you're buying a company you consider a good company, right? This is not a turnaround. This is not something where you're like, you've got issues or these kind of things to fix. I mean, obviously there's low hanging fruit and everything else, but it's not, you like the company, it's solid. It's got a lot of great metrics that it makes. So what are you really investing in? You're really investing in the CEO, and that's really what you're investing in. That's the person you really want to put your money in, and that's who you're going to grow. And that's how, one of the things we talk about picking out searchers is I try and figure out and utilize that 2-year window to decide, is this somebody I really want to back as a CEO? Is this a person that I really believe can run it? And in more cases than not, luckily, it's always somebody that I really like. And occasionally there'll be somebody that I'll back and I'll say, gosh, you know, I don't really know if I want to back this person as a CEO. So, but that's really where you're putting your eggs into that basket, is sort of the baseline being the company and then growing from there with the CEO.
Yeah, I guess how much growth is growth? You know, the IRR that has been generated in this space has been quite admirable by comparison to other asset classes. And so, you know, how bad behavior is bad behavior? if you're getting a sort of 10% per annum growth, you're doing all right, right?
Yeah. Or is that... No, I think you're right. I think that it's just one of those things that, you know, who wants to get involved in the middle of sort of firing somebody and going through the process and everything else unless they are doing something that's really egregious? Look, there's all kinds of things that happen with searchers where, and I just had this conversation with another searcher about the difficulty of searching, is that I know great CEOs, some of which are strategic advisors for Victorium, who for no fault of their own have had really a rough time going through the process of their business, be it COVID or you know, Brexit that happened that caused a lot of issues or whatever it was, things along those lines. We have a strategic advisor in the United States whose lead customer stole his IP and just simply said, fine, Yeah. So the whole business sort of crumbled in on itself. It's a, you know, someday you should have him on the podcast. He's got an amazing story, but there's nothing to be done. And he licked his wounds after they sold it for parts and everything else. And then decided to go back out and raise another search fund. Cause he loved what he did. And he raised in a week because everybody loved him as a CEO. They said, of course we'll back you. Problems. So you don't want to fire these individuals. And for the most part, you actually really end up becoming friends and it becomes great relationships and lasts for many, many, many years and decades and everything else. So I think it's greatly exaggerated. And it certainly doesn't surprise me because the individuals who do get fired are going to go around screaming about it, and particularly to any searcher who will listen, right? But the reality is that's a very small, small fractional percentage of individuals.
Yeah. Bramley, I think you might have hit the nail on the head there, sir. And thank you for setting the record straight. That's really helpful to have that straight from someone who's seen across the ecosystem. So just go dialing back a little bit there. You mentioned an increasing number of searchers coming into the space and some sort of innovation or iteration around the model. And of course, there's new money coming here as well. New investors coming to the scene and sort of hopefully keeping step with the increase in the number of acquisition entrepreneurs. But what do you think are the primary opportunities and potentially the challenges of that kind of expansion in this ecosystem? Was it ever meant to be so big? Could it get bigger? And if so, where might it start creaking?
Well, I mean, I personally don't believe search scales, right? Like, I don't think it's designed to scale. Because it's built on individual entrepreneurship, right? It's not built on the idea of creating these massive portfolios. And, you know, if you're raising a $100 million fund, how in the world, even when you build a team, are you going to give real personal support and real mentorship and guidance to every single searcher? You're not. And it's a portfolio approach. And yes, there is a portfolio component to this for investors. Absolutely, 100%. My father wrote a really great article on it through ESA that I think it's just called A Note to New Investors, and it talks about the portfolio approach. But I think one of the key things is these search funds are successful, in my opinion, and sort of the core of what Victorian really is the idea of mentorship and guidance and hands-on experience with these individual entrepreneurs who need that. I mean, the model essentially is taking it's deviated now because you've got a lot of older searchers now, but originally it was taking a newly minted MBA with very little to no experience and sticking them at the front of the train and letting them drive it, essentially. And then the reason that they were able to do that and become successful is because they had this group of mentors behind them, the Bill Egan's, the Will Thorndike's, the Peter Kelly's, you know, the Jan Simons, all those individuals behind that that entrepreneur that made it so that they could be successful and they could make errors and adjust and everything else and go from there. And so what you're losing with a lot of these individuals flooding into the space in terms of investments is you're losing that one-on-one connection that I think in the guidance, the mentorship that these individuals need. And that was the impetus for starting Victorium when Carl and I met through the International Search Fund Center. I brought him on as a sponsor through Gerald Edelman, and we really got along. So we started investing together side by side. And after a year and a half or so, closer to 2 years maybe, of doing that, we sort of had a conversation about this. And I said, you know, we can keep doing what we're doing with our little dry powder and being sort of these players that are somewhere in the middle cap table, or we could actually do a fund and bring back what I really think is sort of absolute crux of what made this really successful and gave us those numbers that we see in the United States, which was this mentorship and everything else. And in part, a lot of that was generated from my conversations with searchers that I was having, where I was asking them, you know, what are you getting from your investors? What do they really bring to the table besides a checkbook? And in many cases, the answer was, you know, not much, or it was, yeah, you know, when I get on a phone call, they're great, but I have to 100% be proactive with them. I have to 100% be the one to follow up and do all the activities, which, you know, look, it's definitely on the searcher to be the proactive one. I don't doubt that. But when I was searching, and you go back to, you know, Mark Atterig, who I had a conversation with not too long on the United States, we both agreed that much, much earlier on, you could call up an investor like a, whatever, I pick somebody like a Kent Weaver out of the blue. You could call him up every other week if you wanted to have a conversation. He would take the call and have that conversation. Now, if you have 200 plus searchers, you're not going to be taking 200 phone calls every week, right? So it's not something that's really feasible in a way that really work. And so that's what I think, that there's no real way to scale this. And there are other things that I think go around the scaling, but for the most part, that's what I really think is going to be lost in the community grow like that.
Yeah, like you say, inherently the owner-operator model kind of clips your wings anyway, right? Because you're immersed building this company, so it's not like you can necessarily build an empire in that time. I think people have gone on to have sort of serial acquisitions and holdcos, etc., from Search, but like you've got your work cut out, clearing the senior debt, getting the seller's note away, and delivering growth for your investors over that kind of 5 to 7 year cycle. So that's going to keep you busy. But to your point about saturation, yeah, I've seen kind of these institutions. You think of Ambit and Istria and Relay, and they've professionalized in the way they do their investment management and board meeting attendance, and that they've had to swell the numbers in terms of the staff in the funds. But frankly, yes, there's a point, right? There's a constructed portfolio, and that reaches its peak. Yeah, interesting point that it's not necessarily meant to scale. But of course, we're faced with this other side of the coin where there's an abundance of businesses that need to be bought. Acquisition entrepreneurs are getting, spat out of the sausage maker with MBAs, et cetera. And they've got to go somewhere. So if
Sure.
not Trad Search, where?
No, I mean, yeah, I think as like I said at the beginning, I think there's a lot of searchers who are coming in the space. It probably wouldn't be searchers if there wasn't this flood of money into the space. With this huge amount of investors that are now in the space, allowing individuals to raise, I think people are willing to sort of spread their money around and say, okay, we'll take risks on, more and more and more and more searchers. And not the kind of driven down depth there was way back when, where it actually was difficult to raise. I mean, it was common to take 4 to 6 months to raise. That was not an unheard time. Now you talk to people at month four and you'd think that they'd been, spending the last 6 years trying to raise, the way that they're exasperated by the process. And now there's and this happened in the US, and I certainly was probably guilty of it back in the day, but now there's a whole, bragging rights of speed of raise kind of thing. Oh, I was able to raise in, X amount of time. And I have to remind people all the time, constantly, when I talk to searchers, that there's absolutely no correlation between speed of raise and success of search, but there is an enormous correlation between quality of cap table and quality of board that comes from that cap table and success of search. And so it's far, far, far more important for searchers to build that cap table very specifically, spend the time, interview the investors that you're talking to. It's a two-way interview. Yep, you're the one asking for the money, so obviously you're really the one who's getting interviewed, but you are interviewing them to a degree and get a sense of what they're really going to bring back to the table for you, and then build your cap table based upon that, knowing that in the next 5 to 10 years, these people are going to be the people you're working with. This is going to be your board, and they're going to the quality of how well you do is going to be directly from that.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, to your point, the speed of raise is often a proxy for size of network or activation of moneyed part of your network. I mean, we're seeing tech exited tech entrepreneurs raising very quickly from sometimes VCs that they return some capital to from their last exit, for example, to back them as they move into search. And great, that's fabulous, that momentum to get them out there and searching quickly, fab. But like you say, no correlation between that and a successful acquisition or a successful onward, return distribution from that acquisition. So yeah, really worthwhile knowing. Go on.
I was going to add one little other touch, is that it was something that Mark Egan and I were having a discussion on, and I agree with this. In terms of this flood in the space of both searchers and money, is what one of the things we're also seeing is deal quality is starting to go down substantially. And it used to be that when you'd see a deal, and we all know that there are these metrics that the company's got to tick, recurring revenue, low CapEx, fragmented market, all these things that are in Jan's book and that kind of stuff. They would tick five or six of those boxes, or four or five or whatnot of them. And now we're seeing one or two, and I'm seeing deals that wouldn't have stood a chance back then getting done. And again, I think it's the fact that people are willing to say, well, I can put that in my portfolio, and if it does well, it's more of that sort of PE blockbuster mindset of, look, I only need 3 of 10 to do really well, and then I've covered everything, right? Kind of stuff.
Oh goodness, the power law.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know that firsthand because I don't have, luckily, we're not running into a ton of like bad deals on that level, but I do see a lot of deals, particularly the gap deals that come along, where people are trying to fill a gap, where I'm like, God, this is, it's heavy manufacturing, there's no recurring revenue, it's da 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 da, all these kind of things that just don't fit the model, and they're getting those deals done. So I think that's another element that goes into it.
I think competition has got a big part to play in that. I think, here we are, 2025, lower mid-market private equities coming further down the ladder, further down the value chain. More searchers, more capital needing to be allocated. The quality of deals, I think the sort of buy box gets constrained a little bit. But let's hope that there's, a way around that, for want of a better phrase. Could we speak a bit to your searcher selection? What do you think makes a good searcher? What kind of traits and qualities do you look for? Maybe not just in the searcher, but also in the deal while we're on that topic.
I get asked it a lot, well, National Search Fund Center, what can I do to make myself stand out? What can I do to make this different? And without being too negative on it and to steal some words from some other investors, there is a much of it is a dart throw to pick out searchers, because you spend an average, like, what, 3 hours maybe talking to them over the course of interviews. Maybe you spend a total of five or whatever. Some of the big funds have a longer process that they run through and that kind of stuff. At the end of the day, you're sort of judging somebody pretty narrowly in terms of whether or not you think they can be good. And there have been individuals where I've sort of said, well, I like him and I'm not 100% sure, but I'm going to take him on. They've turned out to be amazing. And I've had other ones that I thought were going to be real home runs and they were not. So there's no way of knowing two things, whether somebody's going to be a good searcher. And the only way you're going to know if they're going to be a good CEO is spending real time with them through the search process and really understanding whether they're going to be a good CEO. And so in terms of quality that I look for, I mean, I like to see things like, human capital management, people management skills, essentially, which is something that I full-heartedly believe, whether it's right or not, that is innate to people. I think you can learn some things about it, but some people are just good with people and some people just aren't. And I don't think there's
Yeah,
a
authentically,
Yeah,
authentically.
exactly.
That EQ, you could sound like you're just, regurgitating theory, or you can actually live it and breathe it, and it comes from the heart, right? And I think you can tell that after a fact.
Precisely. Precisely. That's 100% it. And so I like to see a lot of that. I really like to try and find the individuals that have the tenacity and drive to be able to go to them, to go and they really want to do search for the right motivations. I mean, that's a big one. And that one's one that I really try and suss out, that they didn't just see some numbers that somebody had thrown on a board and said, the average search fund CEO leaves with $5 to $8 million or whatever the numbers are now. There's something ridiculous and it's completely wrong. I just want to get that out there to everybody. Those numbers are absolutely wrong and incorrect. And yes, if you throw in all the top performers and everything else and all that kind of stuff and pile it on top, sure you can get to those numbers. But I know plenty of searchers who did excellent jobs, who are great CEOs that did not walk away with those kind of numbers.
Yeah.
So
Certainly,
it's
whenever I model it, it doesn't look like that's the level of return for the manager, for the
right.
operator. Yeah.
Exactly. And so I really want to see that they are doing these for the right motivations. And you want to find people who are willing to stick it out, like the Mark Bartomeus's, who took 3.5 years to find his company. Saqib Ansari, who's been grinding out with a really wonderful business in the UK, but was hurt by COVID and Brexit and a whole bunch of other things and whatnot, a strategic advisor of ours, who's an excellent CEO. So you really want to find individuals like that. And look, if anybody had the secret sauce, if anybody Pacific Lakes or Relays or Anacapas or whoever it was had the secret sauce, they could bottle it and sell it to all of us and we'd buy it up, tomorrow. At God knows what inflated prices they could sell for that, because no one has been able to solve the riddle of how to pick a searcher, right? And the search process in and of itself, fundamentally, I always believe, and I still believe this, is 70% luck, 30% opportunity meets preparation. And there's just so much blind luck into being at the right place at the right time, talking to the right seller and the right mind frame with the right company, right? I mean, the stars sort of do align. And a lot of people do buy companies, and you think, oh, maybe it is easier. Well, the problem is that a lot of people buy the wrong companies. And so they buy a company that either is not going to do great returns, or at the end of the day, they bought themselves a job. And, you know, it's sort of rough from the investor point of view to look at it, because you're looking at it as a portfolio play, and it's like, well, you know, that's just one of my minis. Well, for that one individual searcher, that's their career, and they're going to spend the better part of their years doing it. So it's why it's so important to make sure that you get the right business at all costs, and to avoid rose-colored glasses when you're looking at deals.
Wise words, very wise words. Thank you very much. And that's spoken as somebody that you know, ran a search and has looked at a lot of businesses over the years, right?
Yeah.
So I imagine a number of our listeners will be familiar with your journey from listening to Found and Funded, and you know, when you were appearing with Carl. Just to your earlier point, yeah, it's impossible not to love Carl. He's a fantastic human being, and I can totally see why you guys are pursuing Victorium Equity together. So that's obviously come to pass since you were on Carl's podcast a few months ago. Should we bring everybody up to date? What's Victorium Equity? And you know, you're effectively talking about going back to the root of search funds with that. So I'd love to get into it.
Yeah, so, you know, like, as I mentioned before, Carl and I sort of saw this, and we said there's an opportunity here, maybe not even just an opportunity, but it's something that we wanted to give back in terms of community, to be able to go back to the idea of saying, you know, what made search, in our opinion, successful was that true mentorship and guidance and support that I think is now sort of shifting away with all the new investors and the tons of money flooding in for searchers. And so we discussed it, and so we put together Victorium with the idea of saying, this is what we're going to do. We're going to intentionally keep this as a smaller fund by design, so that we can really support these individuals. And, you know, if our theory proves correct, hopefully our returns reflect that as well for both our LPs and our searchers. And so, you know, one of the things that we're trying to do is build out a back end for searchers to be able to support them, as well as being readily available for searchers, you know, to be able to sit around and have conversations. Having gone through the search process myself and having not acquired, I like to think that gives me a little street cred in terms of with searchers to say, look, I've been in those trenches and I actually understand what it's like to go and search day in and day out and really grind away at it, which can be really brutal, especially if you're doing it as a solo searcher. I mean, it was a tough thing to do. And so I bring a lot of sort of that history and experience to the table and understand different ways to get around certain things and processes that made things better for me, as well as knowing like what I would have liked back then that I didn't have that we can bring to the table. So that's really what we're trying to do with Victorium, is to sort of bring a lot of that sort of older sort of, well, the sort of founding principles, I guess you'd say, or whatnot, into Victorium that I think some funds definitely have. Don't get me wrong, there are definitely some great funds out there, and I don't want to knock any of the funds. There's some really awesome funds that really do a lot to support their searches and do a good job. I just think that you've got, with all the new money flooding in, individuals who don't really understand search and are only 3 years or 5 years or 2 years into the process of learning about search and everything else, have not really dove in and understand that the whole point is to back these searches and to really not just be a blank check for them.
Yeah, absolutely. That smart money, that active investor, active cap table piece. Yeah, that was one of the roots, as you mentioned, of search. And hopefully you can bring it back, make search great again.
Oh, God. You're going to have to edit that one out for sure. I can't be the American with that on there. No way.
Well, thankfully it was the Englishman saying it, so that's fine. sorry, Brownlee. So what you mentioned there about stuff that was missing previously that you wish you had when you were searching, like, could you speak a bit more about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, things that were missing, and I think a lot of it was sort of on my shoulders. One of the things that I want to do with Victorium is to offer that sort of sounding board to searchers. And it wasn't so much missing. I certainly had some great investors that I talked to regularly and had it, but it was certainly something that I probably didn't utilize enough, which was to be able to go and talk with them. So one of the things that I think searchers find is there's an intimidation factor, right? You have yourself and then you have your investors, and while they're not your bosses, they sort of are, you know, they've given you all this money, and some of them have these just resumes that are just absolutely, you know, breathtaking, like, you know, the Will Thorndike kind of thing. This guy's practically certified genius. genius if he's not. I think so. But, you know, he was the kind of guy that, do I want to call up and just sort of spitball an idea at a company? Probably not, because I'm too nervous. What if he's like, oh God, I just put money into this kid and he's looking at that. I made a huge mistake here. So you wanted somebody that you could really have sort of a good conversation with easily. And it's not, I'm sure Will would be willing to do that, but it was the intimidation factor from my end. It was sort of the worry of going there. So for Victorian, what we want to offer to our searchers is the ability to say, hey, give us a call, you know, give me a call. Hey, let's chat about anything you want. You want to knock around an idea. You want to discuss a company before you take it out to the wider investor base. It's something that I've done with countless searchers at this point, something I've done with lots of them to look over deals and to discuss, you know, how to put it together or what the problems is, or, you know, will people actually look at this and think I'm crazy, and you know, discussing things before it goes to the wider base. The other thing I guess I could point to is just sort of ramp up time. It's something that I would have liked to have known about. Everybody, I think, no matter what goes into search, thinking it's easier than it is, even if they know it's hard, and they fundamentally are like, oh, this is going to be hard. It's harder than you can realize, I think. And so it certainly was for me. And, you know, I didn't realize how difficult it was going to be simply just sourcing the right companies and finding those sort of needle in the haystack. And so there's a ramp up period from when you start out searching. And my recommendation to searchers is always start, like, even when you're before you're raising or right when you start raising, start searching, get out there, start pounding the pavement, get a lot of those sort of bugs out of the system and sort of figure it out. And don't wait until you've raised to start, okay, day one, we'll do, you know, this is the first day. Now I'm going to build my CRM and I'm going to build my outreach machine and bring on interns. Start, you know, sooner than later. And certainly I would have liked to have ramped up faster, I think, from my search, which is, you know, can anybody, you know, anywhere from 3 to 6 month period, and 6 months out of 2 years is a significantly long period of time. So
that's really refreshing to hear you saying that, Bradley, because there are still, you know, a contingent of search fund investors that believe you should focus on raising your search first, which, I mean, the differentiator surely has got to be your ability to find good deals, right? If we are reaching a point where we've got more searchers in the trad sense than there is money for them, hearing reports that, you know, the traditional investors are taking a bit more time to make their decision because they've got more options, and that's not so bad. But if you're going to them with a deal or some real candidates that you can have a proper grown-up conversation about, then that's a different type of interview than just, hey, can I have your money for 2 years while I look? I mean, yeah. So it's why we built BizCrunch, frankly, is to kind of galvanize that process and expedite that process and make it kind of feasible to put your search almost on autopilot to some extent, and then focus your efforts on having those seller conversations carved out from time that you'll be having those investor conversations. And I think there's mutual kind of exponent to that, where, you know, one will drive the other and vice versa. So I'm all to your earlier point about the giving the permission to kind of have these conversations and to be a supportive investor. Something I saw working really well in the venture space is office hours. And I don't know anybody that's really doing like office hours where people can collectively learn from each other and from other people's questions to kind of an expert. They tend to be these kind of closed shop one-to-one conversations, which are neither time efficient nor exponentially beneficial for the community, because everybody's asking the same bloody question. No one's learning from other people's answers, which kind of seems a bit inefficient. So, you know, have you contemplated, you and Carl contemplated office hours?
Yeah, I mean, well, you're talking for community or for our searchers?
You tell me.
Well, so for our searchers, we certainly will have something. And I'm Ack and Louie of Wayfinder in Australia do a great thing where I think it's once a month they get their searchers and their CEOs on calls together to just sort of talk and spitball about things or discuss problems or to do these kind of whatever it was. And back when I was a searcher, we had like a happy hour meeting once a month that we'd all get together and cry in our beer about the deals that got away. And we certainly will do the same kind of concept here with Victorian. We'll certainly have some of that back end elements to have everybody together to learn from one another or to be able to discuss anything. One of the things I like to remind searchers, no matter who you've got on your cap table or whatnot, and it's grown a lot, but for the most part, you're not competing against each other. You know, you're going back to the same wells for money. So I don't want to find out that somebody's bidding my deal up against some other searcher that's bidding the deal up, right? It doesn't make any sense. And so one of the things was that, at least when with my cohort, we were all sort of, you know, brothers in arms, if you will. We, you know, people would kick each other deals sometimes. Like, I don't really, this is not really for me. It's not my wheelhouse, or I don't, you know, but you can take a look at it, you know, or I've got a great intern, you know, you should use this intern. And they work together, and it really sort of created a great community. I see a lot of searchers now sort of talk about things in a much more competitive tone. And I think, you know, you're not competing, and the odds of you guys even ending up on the same deal are so infinitesimal that you guys are going to
really run small.
Yeah. So,
I don't see that often at all. You know, most of the time you're running up against trade or you're running up against private equity, very rarely against another searcher.
Exactly, 100%. So to answer your question, yes, I think we would. And I know that we've talked about some other elements of doing some other things for the community that would be, I don't know if they'd be sort of office hours kind of thing or not, or how we put it together. But certainly I would love to do stuff for the community. We will have like a back-end area for our Victorium searchers, which we're building out now, which will be the resources and different support elements for them that will include like that. So, yeah, I'm excited about a lot of that stuff.
That's going to be a game changer, Bramley, because, I mean, what a differentiator, my friend. Wow.
Hopefully. Hopefully it is. Hopefully it's good.
No doubt. You set a high bar. So thesis, do you want to, I don't want to dwell on any kind of metrics or anything like that, but do you have anything you want to share at a high level about thesis, maybe in terms of verticals or geographies or any particular impact missions that Victorium's on?
Well, I mean, we don't have anything that I would say that's, you know, oh, we're this sector, that sector. We're certainly, you know, agnostic in terms of we'll look at, you know, anything that the searchers bring to the table. What I like to do is again, because we want to work sort of more granular with them, is to almost already know a lot of the deals before they've even been announced to the broader cap table and have sort of good sense of what's coming to the table. I feel like the more that I can be involved, hopefully I'm bringing more value to the searchers and more value to the deal, and the deal will then reflect on that, and we'll see the success reflected as they move forward. So we don't have anything specific that we're going to say, you know, this industry or that. And in terms of searchers, I'm not a believer that a searcher needs to tick certain boxes. I know that some people say, oh, if they don't have an MBA or they don't have this or they don't have a financial background, I'm not going to invest with them. You know, there are investors I know who will only invest in graduates of certain universities and things like that. I think that's just a way of weeding the field, to be quite honest, so they just don't have to field, you know, endless amount of searchers. You know, I think it may have been Rob from Ambit who was speaking at one of the conferences recently, and he pointed out, which is very true, you know, they're seeing, you know, six searchers a week sometimes, or when it used to be six a month. And back when in my cohort, it might have been two or three a month, kind of thing that an investor would see. And then a lot of times it was in person. You had to go in person. So that was part of the real thing. There was not a lot of the Zoom and everything else where people were willing to give you sort of search money. So you were crisscrossing the United States, going to Boston and New York and Denver and Los Angeles and San Francisco to meet up with all these individuals, you know, to be able to try and raise your search capital.
That would be a hell of a lot of air miles if Rob was to be going and meeting all of his prospects. Researchers, because yes, he's leading the four in all these emerging markets, like, you know, India and Singapore and you know, South Africa and places like that, and, you know, where he's almost part of the kind of crusade or mission to bring it to those territories. And so, yeah, I mean, no wonder he's seeing that many searchers, because you know, he's at the forefront of opening up these new territories. So great. Okay, so no specific limitations, which is great to hear. I just want to analogize slightly or adjacency to some of the activities that you spearheaded when you were at the International Search Fund Center and obviously throughout your career, but like the European CEO Summit, Women in Search Forum, like you have been kind of blazing trails to try and make search accessible to, you know, wider audience, want of a better phrase, wider participation. Sure. So does that in some way play into Victorium today?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I certainly am proud and thrilled with those. They turned out to be great events. And And, you know, I would love to have Victorum continue to sponsor the community and to be active about it. The Women Search Network, Sarah Rosenthal, is a wonderful network. I like to support that. I think we'll hopefully be doing still work with them. Both the CEO Summit and the Investor Summit with the ESA, I think, have proved to be wildly successful for both investors and CEOs. And we'd love to, you know, with Jared Edelman and Carl, continue to sponsor it and back those kind of events. I can't tell you what the new things will be down the pipe, but I certainly hope and look forward to putting together some more events for the community as well. I think it would be great to have, I think it'd be really beneficial to have something along the lines that is a little bit more of the realism of search for potential searchers. It talks a little bit more about the nitty-gritty and you know, not necessarily all the positive or the big spin or anything else, but really talks about sort of the pitfalls and the trials and tribulations individuals go through and what it looks like when you don't succeed on either your search fund or whether you don't succeed in terms of hitting the metrics with your company or having a company that completely falls apart, and to no fun, no fault of your own. And so I think it'd be good to have a lot more of that, and we may dive into that a little bit more. So
Oh yeah, please do. I think you can't do enough of that, or too much of that, rather. I mean, you know, there is this kind of rose-tinted glasses possibility, particularly for folks coming out of business school where the reality hasn't yet set in. We ran a symposium last week, and we were over-indexing on the warts and alls kind of stories about, you know, what's it like in the trenches, post-deal reality, you know, because it isn't all land of milk and honey. You know, there's some dragons that you got to fight along the way. So. To that end, I mean, if you've got one pearl piece of advice for a sort of an emerging searcher embarking on a journey today, you know, what would you want to impart so that they, you know, could avoid the landmines that maybe we've all stepped on?
Well, one piece of advice. You know, one of the key things I think, and something that I wasted time when I did my search, and I know a lot of other searches, is really know your owner and really know why they're selling and make sure that they're real sellers. I've seen this happen time and time again. It happened myself where the seller really wasn't a real seller, or they really weren't ever going to let go of the business, or they really didn't understand like what they were offering. You know, one of my sellers, one of the one the big one, I had several deals that failed, but the big one that failed, actually, the seller came back at the 24th hour and said, I don't remember them, this is too long ago, I don't remember the specific numbers, I'm sort of making it up, but he said, you know, I want $3 million more dollars on this deal, or whatever it was. Long story short, it was very suspiciously close to the amount of money he had to pay in taxes in the US. And so he had done, and this is pure theory and conjecture, and if he sees this, he'll probably say it's BS. Although I doubt he will, but you never know. It's a
Don't get
small world.
sued.
I know. I think he'd spent the money in his head and realized that he had to pay this huge tax bill, and then all of a sudden wanted to cover the tax bill and sort of went back and wanted his money. I don't know if that's the case, but either way, the whole point is that he really had not thought through the whole process. And in the 25th hour, all of a sudden it came flooding to him and he wanted to change the deal. And I've seen that same similar thing happen time and time again. I had an associate in my cohort as well who had a deal that blew up with him on the last minute. And the son came out of nowhere and said, Dad, I want this company. And the whole time he knew about this son who was floating around in the ether, who really didn't do anything. He had no real direction. And the searcher knew this. And I think, unfortunately for him, it was one of these things where the son was like, oh my God, you know, that's my gravy train. If the gravy train leaves, I'm not going to get anything. And so all of a sudden he wanted back on board. So I think it's these, got to find these little tweaks. And I tell searchers all the time to ask your seller over and over and over again, why are they selling, and make sure that the answer is consistent. And then the second thing is make sure they do it, even though I've told this about my deal where they had already spent the money. Have them spend the money in their head, have them spend the correct amount of money in their head, but have them spend the money in their head and know what they want to go do. You know, like if they ever wanted to sail the world or go on some sort of crazy trip or whatever, and get excited about that, so that the idea of losing their baby, you know, that they're going to have to sell on, is not quite as painful as it could be, where they're like, oh, I'm going to sit at home all the time and twiddle my thumbs now. And to be like that. So I think that's one of the top pieces.
A neat trick to mitigate for that. Here's a hack for you. Introduce them to a wealth manager. Okay. No, seriously. I mean, there's going to be plenty of them want to meet them. But while they're emerging and becoming this, like, you know, this liquidity event is happening, this wealth event is happening, introduce them to a wealth manager, and they will help them imagine their life post deal quite comfortably on your behalf.
Yeah. Agreed. Absolutely agree. That's a good one.
Sorry. Cool. And you've also mentioned, like, previously in advice, like, kill your deals early, and you're qualifying, like, to your point there about the seller's mindset. Are they intellectually, emotionally committed to be parting with their baby? Like, you can't ask that too many times. I mean, ad infinitum. But killing the deals piece, I'm really curious about that. I advocate for the same, but I'm just interested if our reasoning correlates.
Yeah, so we have on the back end of Victorium a quick kill list that we give searchers where they can go through and they can see reasons to sort of eliminate deals and to eliminate sellers pretty quickly. And you really need to sort of identify what is it about, you know, either a company or a seller or anything else that would make it sort of a quick kill. And there's a lot of them. There's a whole bunch of them. I the number one thing I always say is it's got to check some of those boxes, right? And if you go, TTCER did a brilliant presentation. It's proprietary to them on the top performing search fund areas. And one of the key things was they all had very similar characteristics across the board. And so I always say that you want to see things with recurring revenue or meaningful repeat, right? And that will give you the ability. You know, I'm going to use Mark Bartomeu's words here, but I'm probably going to butcher it. So forgive me, Mark. But, you know, he had 70% revenue that was coming in that he could know was going to arrive there. So it allowed him to focus more on areas that he really had to sort of change and adjust as he was going forward. And so you really want to see that sort of revenue coming in that you can rely on. And then you want to tick a lot of those other little boxes that go into it, whether that be fragmented market or low capex, or, you know, I like to see simple businesses. I like to say simple, boring businesses. I like to see those kind of things. That means that you've got something you can really sort of grow, you can really focus on and get your hands dirty. The learning curve is not too steep for the new CEO. So along those lines, those are sort of some of the things that I think that you'd want to see in the businesses.
Yeah, I think it's important that searchers realize they've got the permission to kill deals early. Like, yeah. I think often people emotionally attach, like, oh, I found one. I must make this work. But no, because there's about 75,000 more where that came from, far more than there are people that want to buy them. So, you know, the you have the whip hand ultimately as the buyer to decide whether this is really one you want to devote your days and your investors' funds to. So I love that list of, like, does it fail at these points? If so, if in doubt, throw it out.
Exactly. You know, one of the things that it's really easy for searchers to get deal fever, and I can't fault it because I've been there, done it. I know exactly how it feels. And it's, you look at it sometimes, especially if you're 12 months, 14 months in your search, you say, is this the last one? Is this the last one I'm going to have on the line? Is this the last fish? Can I, you know, how much longer have I gone in runway? You know, and you start sort of sweating bullets and you start sort of really feeling it, and it starts to become easier and easier to overlook things in the deal. And you have to remember that your investors are going to do their diligence, but they're not going to do your work for you. They're going to believe you did your diligence. And so if you haven't done your full diligence, it is possible that things are going to come through and that they're not going to get picked in the QE. I mean, if you know, look at your QE when you get it. There's a whole huge 2-3 pages in the front that says, we're not liable for anything if this is all wrong. Like, this is your show. Like, we.
Oh, yeah.
And so it really is down to the searcher. And I always have to sort of impress that on them. Like, you know, do your diligence. Find reasons, you know, shouldn't say find reasons to kill the deal, but make sure that you've checked those boxes and that you're not leaving anything in there. You're not hedging something and saying, well, you know, this could be, if I do this and that, adjust this, maybe it'll find the good ones, because what makes the difference between a okay search fund acquisition or a bad one and a great one is them acquiring the right business. It's really down to getting that right business.
Yep. I mean, just interested in the Q of E piece, you know, the whole massive disclaimer. Also, typically you're signing a client care letter with a lot of these professional service providers, which pretty completely absolves them of responsibility for, you know, the outcome of their advice. So, yeah. It is entirely on you, my brother. That's just part of the journey, right? Cool. Bramley, I've really enjoyed this conversation. It's been fabulous, and I think the listeners will find this super insightful. Is there any particular takeaway that you'd like them to have in terms of, you know, engaging with Victorium, how to contact you, etc.?
Sure. Well, I mean, so for searchers, if you're interested in connecting with us, you can always send an email to searcher@victoriumequity.com and schedule a meeting with myself there. We can have a conversation from there. Our focus is European and North America, but I certainly am always happy to talk to anybody in the community. And even if you just want to discuss advice, I've done that for many searchers where, you know, I'm up front and said, look, you're not in our wheelhouse, but happy to talk. And we get on a call and we have a great conversation. And if you're an investor and you're interested in talking about Victorium, you can always send an email directly to me, just bramley@victoriumequity.com, and we can connect on that one. And obviously, you can visit the website if you want, victoriumequity.com, to see a little bit more about our thesis and whatnot.
Yeah, and the deck's great, and I think you're making some real headway with your commits from LPs, so only a matter of time now before you're allocating, so I'm really excited for the kind of searches you're going to back and the kind of funds you're going to bring to this space. So, and of course, all the massive support that you're going to bring to this space through the sort of return to the roots model here. I'm loving it. Very excited. So, and I'm sure our listeners and viewers are excited too, and will join me in saying a big thank you for your candor and your ongoing undying support of the space. So thank you again, Bramley.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Folks, we'll wrap it there, and we'll tune in next time for another interview. Can't promise it'll be as insightful as this one, but, you know, bear with us. But until then, keep on crunching. Bye for now.